Today is Monday, August 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington.
A throwing projectile. All persons must immediately leave the area by traveling west and staying out of the roadway.
Sunday brought continued protests in the northwestern U.S. city of Portland, Oregon, as concerns grow over militias entering cities.
Right-wing militias are one of the most dangerous terrorist organizations and groups in the United States.
Plus the latest on the global pandemic, technology keeping streets safe, and a look back at the life of actor Chadwick Boseman. We'll have these stories and more next. Sunday night brought continued protests in the northwestern U.S. city of Portland, Oregon, along with pledges from the state's governor to both reinforce police and address the underlying issues that have driven months of demonstrations against racial injustice. Police and protesters clashed on Sunday, one night after a man was fatally shot in the city. After declaring an unlawful assembly, police began arresting demonstrators. At a news conference on Sunday, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler responded to a flurry of tweets and retweets from U.S. President Donald Trump, including several that blamed him for the death. Wheeler says the president has it all wrong.
It's you who have created the hate and the division. It's you who have not found a way to say the names of black people killed by police officers, even as people in law enforcement have. And it's you who claimed that white supremacists are good people.
Wheeler went on to say that the president created hate and division throughout the country.
Your campaign of fear is as anti-democratic as anything you've done to create hate and vitriol in our beautiful country.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown said in a statement late Sunday that everyone, including elected officials, law enforcement, and community leaders, needs to come together to stop the cycle of violence in Portland, and that real change will come from the hard work to achieve racial justice. She also criticized the actions of armed right-wing vigilantes who have confronted protesters in various U.S. cities. With concern growing over groups of militias taking the law into their own hands in cities where there are protests over racial injustice, International Edition's Lori London spoke with criminal defense attorney Jack Rice in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which has also seen its share of unrest following the death of George Floyd while in police custody.
Right-wing militias are one of the most dangerous terrorist organizations and groups in the United States. There's a study that came out that actually said so from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. They looked back at everything from 1994 onward, and what they found was that the growth of right-wing militias is bigger, more intense, and more dramatic than any other group in the United States, including religious zealots. The fear that we're seeing right now is in places like Portland, in places like Kenosha. If we want to go way back, we can look at Charlottesville early in this president's term of office. And what we find is not only are they more active, they're more aggressive, but it also appears that they're actually being supported, at least from the bully pulpit, from the president himself. And that is particularly disturbing.
What do they believe they're charged to do?
That's part of the difficulty, because what we're seeing right now is a president who's actually creating this sort of good guy, bad guy, on the right side of the law, on the wrong side of the law. And he's describing these militias, these groups, as being allies of the police. The problem is in many ways, and places like Portland, the police have actually become allies with them. But if you consider what it is to be a person of color who's protesting, who's actually out doing what it is the First Amendment says they can do, and you see right-wing militias, hate groups, allying with the police themselves, doesn't that support the very contention of what they're arguing? And that's part of the problem. And now there's a face-off, and the police pull back, and they actually let the right-wing militia groups do what it is that they do. This isn't just rhetoric. In the last week, one of those right-wing groups in Portland called the Proud Boys actually came in, fought directly against protesters, and the police stood back and watched. I'm coming to you from Minneapolis, and what we're seeing right now is there were people in the streets just several days ago. And what we see is so much tension in the streets of this country, not Democratic streets, not Republican streets, but U.S. streets. It is a tinderbox.
The recent shooting in the back of a black man in Kenosha, Wisconsin, protests ensued. And then a few days later, a 17-year-old now charged with murder came with a rifle, with an assault rifle, and killed two people and severely wounded another. He's basically a part of these so-called militias as well. My question is, are all of these people in these militias, is this even legal?
One of the studies that has been conducted over the last few years has found that right-wing militia groups have infiltrated the police department themselves. And I think that's consistent with this concept of the police and some right-wing militias actually seeing themselves as allies. And that is exactly why some people are in the streets arguing exactly as they are. Look, this is one of the biggest problems facing the national security establishment right now. They're trying to figure out how to pivot from not just extremists from abroad, but what happens when you have extremists at home? This is all well and good until you realize that the biggest domestic threat in America is right-wing militia groups. And when they think that they're actually above the law, that means they can do whatever it is they think they want to do. The debate right now is, are there sufficient laws in place to address this? And think of it this way. If you have people walking in the streets armed, should you stop them? Should you address this? Is it illegal for a 17-year-old to be walking in the streets armed? The answer is no. The answer in Kenosha, Wisconsin is no, it's not.
So what about Portland now?
Well, in a case like Portland, it's the same situation. If you see people walking in this environment armed, is it appropriate for the police to stop and address the issue? And the answer is yes, but it has to be done consistently, and it has to be done for everybody, not just those people that they deem to be a threat, especially when people who might very well be white and look like right-wing militias are given a pass, and anybody who is of color is grabbed and wrestled to the ground. It really, again, highlights the reason that there are so many people in the streets. It's because institutional racism exists. We have seen it for centuries. It continues to this day. And all this does is to continue to support that very concept.
As we get closer and closer to the election, it seems these tensions are not quieting, but they're actually getting bigger. How concerned are you from a legal standpoint that this is going to continue spreading to other cities across the country and turn into something we've never seen?
I'm very concerned. If we think about the threats that we face collectively as a people, we realize that people of color have been facing this for 400 years. And some are simply saying, let's start with peace and then we'll address this. My response is that people of color have been crushed under the wheel of quote unquote peace, waiting for something to happen. Do you feel that they're going to simply sit back now and say, oh, sure, I can wait another 400 years? That's the problem. If you think about a 17-year-old boy who is actually not allowed to carry a firearm and the R-15 openly as he did, and he wasn't stopped, that tells you about systemic racism, because they see him, the police see him, and they don't see a threat. Think about what that means when you're an African-American who gets stopped just for driving, not driving illegally, but just driving while black.
That was criminal defense attorney Jack Rice speaking with International Edition's Lori London. President Trump is scheduled to visit Kenosha, Wisconsin Tuesday, and VOA's Arash Arabasadi has this look ahead.
Saturday, demonstrators again took to the streets in Kenosha, Wisconsin, days after the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Blake was shot in the back 7 times. He survived, but his family says he is paralyzed from the waist down. Days after the shooting, a white teenager armed with a rifle opened fire on a group of demonstrators, hitting 3 and killing 2. Cell phone video showed him later still carrying his rifle and casually strolling by police. The incident has renewed calls for police reform. Racial injustice protests also continued in the city of Portland, Oregon, where one person was killed amid violent clashes between Black Lives Matter protesters and Trump supporters. Sunday morning, President Trump tweeted law and order, and his acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, called for restraint.
If you're going to protest First Amendment right, please do that peacefully. Once you cross the line to violence, that is what's concerning to the Department of Homeland Security. That's what I'm focused on, making sure that we bring any type of violence in any of our cities to a close.
Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar rejected attempts by President Trump to paint his Democratic rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, as endorsing lawlessness, saying nationwide protests are raging under the current administration.
This isn't just happening in one place. It's happening all over the country. It is happening under Donald Trump's watch. And we have a president that literally stands on the people's lawn and says, oh, do you want to be more safe? We are not safe in Donald Trump's America.
As protests continue, President Trump is due to visit Kenosha on Tuesday to meet local police and survey damage from recent demonstrations following the shooting of Blake. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
And coming up later...
It will give women the opportunity to make better informed choices on the routes they choose. So maybe they would choose to take a route that offers them a higher level of passive surveillance, or meaning that a lot more people will be around or businesses will be open. Lighting is improved in that location.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists have mapped a giant cloud of gas called a halo that surrounds our nearest large galactic neighbor, Andromeda. Using the NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope, the team found that this nearly invisible gas cloud reaches out 1.3 million light years toward our Milky Way galaxy, so that its halo is already bouncing into our galaxy's halo. The scientists, who are part of a survey program called AMIGA, or Absorption Map of Ionized Gas in Andromeda, observed that the halo also extends up to 2 million light years in other directions. The team found Andromeda's halo is composed of two separate layers of gas. The scientists found that this gas cloud holds a stock of star-forming fuel and contains signs of Andromeda's future and past development. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The United States is set to surpass 6 million confirmed coronavirus cases to go along with the world-leading 183,000 deaths the country has recorded. While the United States has the most recorded infections in the world, it ranks 10th based on the cases per capita, with Brazil, Peru, and Chile having higher rates of infection according to a Reuters tally. In addition, Reuters reports that while the United States has the most deaths in the world at just over 183,000, it only ranks 11th for the deaths per capita, exceeded by Sweden, Brazil, Italy, Chile, Spain, the United Kingdom, Belgium, and Peru. Elsewhere, schools and businesses reopened in Auckland on Monday after lockdowns were lifted in New Zealand's largest city to contain the resurgence of the coronavirus, but face masks were made mandatory on public transportation across the country. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that part of the story.
Unlike other parts of the world, New Zealand hasn't ordered citizens to wear face masks since the pandemic began. That changed Monday when Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern required people across the country to wear masks on public transport. The country's biggest city, Auckland, is grappling with a fresh outbreak, though Ardern also lifted a lockdown there the day before. The Prime Minister says she's confident New Zealanders would embrace the new measures, adding that goodwill will help people get through tough times.
We are still a team here, and I think everyone recognises that Auckland has been going through a particularly tough period. What I'd like to ask again is what we've asked all the way through, a bit of kindness, you know, a bit of smiling with the eyes behind the mask.
At train platforms, some commuters wore surgical masks, while others sported more colourful designs. Schools and businesses also reopened in Auckland on Monday, and parents were relieved to have kids returning to classes.
To me, it's so good for them to go back to school. So they've been sitting at home doing nothing. Online work, online school is all right, but it's still not good enough for them. So it's good to get out of the house.
The Pacific nation of 5 million people had seemed to stop community transmission of COVID-19 due to tough lockdown measures, until the Auckland outbreak ended a near 100-day streak without new cases. But a fresh outbreak in Auckland prompted the government to place the city back in lockdown earlier in August.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. Indian forces foiled an attempt by Chinese troops to occupy a hill on the Asian giant's disputed border in the western Himalayas. New Delhi officials said Monday following the latest flare-up between the two nuclear-armed neighbors. China rejected the accusation that People's Liberation Army troops had breached the border, but tensions between the two armies in the freezing snow deserts of the Ladakh region have been running high for several months. Mali's West African neighbors have told the military junta that seized control 10 days ago it must transfer power to a civilian-led transitional government immediately and hold elections within a year. ECOWAS also said it would lift sanctions gradually if the coup leaders complied with four demands. A transitional government must be formed quickly. It must oversee legislative and presidential elections within a year. Mali's transitional president and prime minister must be civilians, and that the new president and prime minister in the transitional period be banned from running in those elections. Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia will announce travel sanctions on about 30 Belarus officials, including President Alexander Lukashenko. Lithuanian President Gitanas Nauseda told reporters sanctions are aimed at officials the Baltic nations accused of rigging presidential elections earlier this month and playing a role in the violence against protesters calling for an end to Lukashenko's 26 years in office. Lukashenko denies electoral fraud and has said the protesters are backed from abroad. Also, Russian President Vladimir Putin used a birthday phone call on Sunday to invite Lukashenko to visit Moscow. Reuters' Emer McCarthy takes things from here.
President Lukashenko, who is celebrating his 66th birthday, denies electoral fraud and has said the protests are backed from abroad. In a statement, the Kremlin said it was agreed to hold a meeting in Moscow in the coming weeks. On Sunday, thousands of protesters marched towards Minsk's Independence Square, which was cordoned off by police in anticipation of the protest. This protester says she came to express her solidarity with detainees and political prisoners and says she stands for peace for Belarus, but not for Lukashenko. An eyewitness told Reuters that police detained at least a dozen people and other protesters were seen resisting arrest by what appeared to be plain-clothed officers.
That was Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy. Artificial intelligence that automatically detects threatening behavior at train stations is part of a new trial to improve safety for women traveling at night in Australia. Phil Mercer has that story.
The New South Wales state government says 9 out of 10 Australian women have experienced harassment on the street. It asked researchers to submit ideas to improve safety as part of its Safety After Dark Innovation Challenge. 4 entries have been chosen and will be tested over the next 6 months. One group from the University of Wollongong will develop artificial intelligence software that will examine real-time feeds from security cameras and alert an operator when it detects suspicious activity or an unsafe environment. The AI will be trained to detect people fighting, agitated behaviour, individuals being followed, and arguments. The university team says the software is a world first and that they were pushing the limits of the technology. Researcher Elizabeth Muscat, who's a transport planner, is also developing algorithms that create safe routes for female travellers.
It will give women the opportunity to make better informed choices on the routes they choose. So maybe they would choose to take a route that offers them a higher level of passive surveillance, or meaning that a lot more people will be around or businesses will be open. Lighting is improved in that location. The end product could be a mobile application where women can, on their own mobile phones, have a application similar to Google Maps or another route finding app where they could be able to choose which route they want to take home.
Authorities in New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, said the range of technology was exciting. Research in 2018 showed that 20% of women in Sydney felt unsafe on public transport. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
On Friday, actor Chadwick Boseman passed away after a prolonged battle with cancer. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder remembers.
Actor Chadwick Boseman, best known for his star turn in the blockbuster Marvel superhero film Black Panther, has died at 43 after a four-year battle with colon cancer. His death was announced on Friday on his Twitter and Facebook accounts. His most memorable role was T'Challa, king of the fictional African kingdom of Wakanda and the crime fighter known as Black Panther. In the first major studio superhero movie featuring a mostly African-American cast. Black Panther was one of the highest-grossing films of 2018, and it was nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture. It won 3 Academy Awards.
I know what it means to see somebody that looks like you and play the hero and the villain, and have the freedom to be both things. So that's a beautiful thing because it frees the human spirit. The key thing as an actor is to not judge the characters that you play. That's how you can play them and actually have compassion on them. So to be able to sit through this movie and go through that inner conflict, it frees up everyone, not just young black men and women, but people of all races.
Boseman originated the Black Panther film role 2 years earlier in Marvel's Captain America: Civil War, and reprised it in 2 Avengers movies. During his screen career, he also played several real-life characters famed for breaking America's racial barriers, including soul singer James Brown in Get On Up, Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall in Marshall, and baseball pioneer Jackie Robinson in 42. Boseman, a native of South Carolina, passed away at his home with his wife and family at his side, the statement said, without specifying when he died. He lived in Los Angeles.
That was Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States wants to ensure that the students on U.S. school campuses know when Chinese language and cultural offerings are subject to manipulation by the Chinese Communist Party and its proxies. The State Department's designation of the Confucius Institute U.S. Center, or CIUS, as a foreign mission of the People's Republic of China, or PRC, recognizes what CIUS is, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, an entity advancing Beijing's global propaganda and malign influence campaign on U.S. college campuses and K-12 classrooms. Confucius Institutes are primarily funded by the Chinese government and are part of the Chinese Communist Party's global influence and propaganda apparatus. This designation will not close the CIUS or require colleges or universities to close individual Confucius Institutes. Instead, the designation of CIUS as a foreign mission will ensure transparency by requiring the CIUS to regularly provide to the State Department information regarding Chinese citizen personnel, recruiting, funding, and operations in the United States. Such reporting will allow U.S. schools to make more informed decisions as to influences being exerted on their campuses and whether these Beijing-backed programs should continue to teach their students. According to the National Association of Scholars, or NAS, there are currently 75 Confucius Institutes operating in the United States. There are also around 500 Confucius classrooms based on K-12 campuses. Most of these are affiliated with one of the university-based Confucius Institutes. The influence of the Chinese government and impact of Chinese Communist Party ideology on Confucius Institute programming has long been a cause for concern on U.S. campuses. For instance, a 2017 report on Confucius Institutes, or CIs, by NAS found that some CI faculty face pressure to self-censor. Contracts between the CIs and host universities are often not publicly available. Some universities are presented with financial incentives to not criticize the PRC, and CI materials often present a selective knowledge of Chinese history by avoiding topics related to human rights abuses. For more than four decades, Beijing has enjoyed free and open access to U.S. society, while denying that same access to Chinese society for Americans and other foreigners in China. The relationship is wildly out of balance, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs David Stilwell. Our goal is to get China to understand the importance of transparency and openness and sharing. But until that happens, we're going to take steps to defend ourselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.